if you're going to finally decide that
this past year in the Philadelphia Inquirer has won a Pulitzer Prize and an award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors. His reporting took him to Lebanon, Cairo, Beirut, Jerusalem, Damascus, Tel Aviv, the West Bank, Haifa. He walked across to report from a long stretch of no man's land between the Fatah commando outpost and the Israeli army front lines. Politics and fighting in the Middle East is to most Americans very complicated, very confusing, and to many very ambiguous. It was Richard Ben Kramer's approach to deal with the Middle East not by writing about political leaders and their latest policy statements, nor did he just update where the latest skirmish was or how many people were killed in the most recent terrorist action. What he did was travel to different cities, different countries, writing about individuals, individual Egyptians, individual Israelis. He wrote about how Israelis view their Arab neighbors, how residents of Arab countries felt about Israelis. He wrote about how war, how terrorism, how hopes of peace are affecting individual lives. And he wrote about war, about killing, from the point of view of the perpetrators and the bereaved. He told compelling stories with compassion and without passing judgment. He's in Philadelphia now. He will be leaving the country in the near future to resume being a foreign correspondent with the Inquirer. Richard Ben Kramer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
First, I want to tell you how much I've enjoyed your series of articles. How did you get to the Mideast? How did you go from reporting on SEPTA and other things to being in the Middle East doing foreign reporting? Was that something you had really aspired to do, or was that just the way fate had it turn out?
Well, a little of both. I had always wanted to go overseas, but I had no plans to do it. I was sitting in New York, which is where I was reporting for the Inquirer, and it was late 77, and Sadat had just been to Israel, and we had had a man from our Washington bureau, Jim McCartney, who's a diplomatic correspondent for us, who'd been in Israel at that time, and had returned dragged out, weary, disheveled. And the next day they announced that Begin was going to Egypt, and Begin would be in Egypt on Christmas Day. Well, Mrs. McCartney announced that Mr. McCartney was going to be nowhere near Egypt on Christmas Day, so they looked around for somebody who could go fast, and they called me in New York and said, be in Egypt in 2 days. So I said, all right.
Had you been following the Middle East? Did you feel very informed about the politics there?
Not really. Well, I had followed the Sadat visit. That was very exciting, I think, to most people. But I was not a student of the Middle East. I knew who won the last couple of wars was about it. And I had read about, like the average American had read, you know, follow the large events. And in the meantime, you just sort of notice that things are boiling over there, but you don't really follow who's who and, you know, who's on whose case.
Your approach to dealing with the Middle East is very different than the other coverage that I've seen of it, because it was dealing with individuals and with individual lives. It was the kind of reporting that is sometimes associated more with feature stories, in the sense that you're dealing with people and emotional reactions. You've described cities as well as individuals and how the war is affecting cities. But again, it was not the kind of reportage of policy and public leaders that one usually finds when, you know, reporting on war in a foreign country or on, you know, troubled times in foreign countries. Did you go with the intention of doing that kind of reporting, or did that emerge from the experience of being there?
Well, that's a kind of reporting that I always think is more interesting than so-and-so, comma, political leader, comma, said yesterday. But the only intention I had when I went there was not to fall on my face too badly. You know, I didn't know too much about it, and I was scared, and I was would have been pleased if I could have got out of there without embarrassing myself in my newspaper. So It was not with any grand scheme that I got on the plane. One of the things that's overlooked in this hubbub about, you know, not covering political leaders and such, which I've heard a lot about lately, is that it's much easier to cover the people who, to me, are more interesting. You know, the people on the street, or the soldiers in the field, or the people whose houses are getting blown up, than it is sitting for 2 weeks, like the poor guy from ABC who has to sit for 2 weeks with, you know, and apply to Sadat for an interview, and apply and kiss his the hand of his press guy, and generally suck up to 1,000 people in an attempt to get Sadat on the air for 30 seconds so that Sadat can say the same thing to him that he just said to the Germans and the French and to NBC and to CBS, you know. To me, it's not interesting, and it certainly isn't very rewarding work applying for audiences with political muckamucks.
It is more clear-cut, though. I mean, if you're out there looking for political leaders, you know who the leaders are, and you might not know how to get access to them, but you know what your goal is. For you, I mean, you couldn't have arrived knowing which Israelis, which residents of Cairo you wanted to talk to, and I mean, your sense of, like, what a good lead was going to be was probably very unclear when you arrived there. How did you get a sense of where you wanted to be and who you wanted to talk to?
Well, I'll tell you, what happened was this. When I first got there, Begin was even then arriving in Egypt, so there was news to be covered, things that people really ought to have known about, how this meeting went between Sadat and Begin. So it gave me 2-3 days of having a very clear-cut assignment, something to watch, something to report it on that was easily defined. But at the end of that, I found that I had just this terrific welter of impressions about Egypt and Egyptians and the Israelis who had visited Egypt at that time, many of them for the very first time in their lives. And I wanted to get this in the paper somehow, so I sat down and I wrote what was a very long piece for most newspapers that tried to put together a little bit of the feeling of Egypt at that time and the aspiration of the people for peace, which was riding high at the time. And I sent that in. I had grave doubts about whether or not it would ever see print, and I got back these telexes from Philadelphia. Great, they said, send us more of that stuff, you know. So then I knew that I could go to a place and write about the aspirations of the citizenry rather than the political leadership, and write about how this conflict that we have been reading about for the last 10, 20 years, or last 50 years, depending on your age, you know, this conflict has gone on as long as anyone's been alive. I could write about the effects of that conflict on regular people, on citizens of those nations, and have an audience that was interested in it in Philadelphia.
It's a very emotional issue, the Middle East dispute, and a lot of people in America have very strong opinions about who's right and who's wrong. A lot of other people, of course, see the issues as being much more ambiguous and muddy. But a lot of people are really opinionated. Did you have opinions before you went there about, you know, which country was being more righteous than the other in this situation? Did you have a sense of taking sides with any of the peoples or countries involved?
Well, I didn't have a very good sense of the politics of the region. I think, like most Americans who read the coverage from the 67 war and the 73 war, I had a small predisposition in favor of this tiny country, Israel, that seemed to be fighting off these vast hordes from across the desert. But I don't think it had developed into any kind of analysis of the region's ills or these problems that had gone on there for so long. What I found developing was not so much a predisposition in favor of one country or one people as opposed to the other. Was what I found develop was a sympathy for the plight of these people, whatever side they happened to be on, because each one of them was in his own way fighting against tremendous odds. the Arabs think of themselves as fighting against the power of the United States and the Western world. The Israelis think of themselves as fighting against the power of the Soviet Union and the Arabs, who far outnumber them. And there are people in marginal conflicts around the central Arab-Israeli conflict who are in their own way outnumbered and outgunned and beset by problems that are much larger and older than themselves, and which they really have very little control of. And in many ways, that it's a region of people trapped in problems that are not of their own making and are probably insoluble during their lifetimes.
You are Jewish now. I don't know whether you are a practicing or non-practicing Jew. For many people, that would be irrelevant, in the sense that many people who are Jewish really believe that one must, if one is born Jewish, side with Israel, because the fighting in Israel has become to them symbolic of the oppression of Jews that has existed throughout the centuries. And to not side with Israel is to kind of be naive, and to be unaware and oblivious to all this cruelty and oppression that has happened. Where do you fit yourself into that?
Well, I don't fit into that, in the sense that I have, by a combination of circumstance and fortune, have been able to see it. So I don't have to base my ideas on the subject on this sort of pat assumption some people use as the foundation of their opinion on what goes on in the Middle East. But I know that attitude is common, because the Inquirer has gotten some mail on this series of Middle Eastern stories that really it's vituperative, this mail. And we print a lot of it because it's interesting. It stirs comment. It stirs debate. People are more emotional about the Middle Eastern situation than they are about any other foreign news story. And the Inquirer, I think, made a lot of enemies in printing the stories that I sent back, not because I was trying to make enemies or because they were, I think, in my opinion, more favorable to one side than the other, but because you can't write about the Middle East without making enemies. That's how emotional an issue it is.
Let me ask you if your family had any emotional reactions to your reporting.
Well, my family, my folks who live in Rochester, New York, they were visitors to Israel. I think they're very proud of Israel. They have a sort of gut sympathy for the people there. On the other hand, I think they have a bigger gut sympathy for me. You know, I mean, to me, parents are fans. You know, if your folks don't like your stuff, you're in bad trouble. You might as well try some other business. But I know that some of their friends, if I wrote something that seemed to be critical of the Israelis in the sense of not following the party line, you know, the World Zionist Congress party line, some of their friends got very disturbed about it. And they had some discussions about it, but my parents, of course, from having seen me grow up, felt that if I was there and that's what I was seeing, and that's probably what was going on. You know, they have sort of implicit trust in me, which I'm very glad about.
One of the things that you brought up in one of your articles that I believe was written from Cairo was that for a lot of people in Cairo, they had never met an Israeli. That, you know, the Israelis were considered the enemy, perhaps, but a kind of vague one, because they'd never really...
Almost diabolical, larger than life.
They'd never met an Israeli face-to-face. And you also say that for many in Cairo, there was no difference between Israeli and Jews, that Jews were Israelis, and differential didn't exist. Did that have a direct effect on you in any way? As a person or as a reporter?
It didn't... It had very little effect on me in the practice of day-to-day reporting. Over the course of the year, I developed many Egyptian friends and many Israeli friends. But the Egyptians, really, my friends at least, came to make a distinction between what was a Jew who lived in America and what was an Israeli, even though in common conversation with their Egyptian friends, they would, when they talked of Israelis, they would call them Jews because there is no real distinction there. But I found that this is a problem not only in Egypt and in Lebanon and Iraq. For the people in those countries looking at Israelis, most of the Israelis also have never met an Egyptian who is not Jewish. They have many Egyptian Jews who have come to Israel to live. But on the other hand, for the European Jews who came to Israel from Poland or from Germany or Russia, many of them have never met a Muslim Egyptian. So it's I find that there's a lot of misconceptions on each side about what the other is. You find if you get an opportunity to cross the lines, you referred to a story that was across a no man's land. There was an Israeli attack into Lebanon, and I was in Lebanon and I went across to the Israeli side. As I passed the last Palestinian checkpoint, they say, "Oh no, you can't go. The Israelis are murderers. They kill for nothing. You know, you just please don't go out there. They'll kill you just because they're Israelis. They just kill, you know." And they thought the Israelis were some kind of monsters. And when I got to the Israeli side, the Israelis said, "You walk through the PLO country. This is unbelievable. They kill. They're just murderers. They murder babies and children." And the Israelis thought the Palestinians were monsters. And there was really no. There's not only no communication, but very little understanding that the other side is comprised of people who have similar problems.
Reading some of your reporting, I really thought of that scene in All Quiet on the Western Front when a Russian soldier finds himself in a trench, a German soldier finds himself in a trench with a Russian soldier, and I can't remember if he shoots the Russian soldier, if the soldier's already been shot, but there's this great sense of, gosh, we're both people, but on the other hand, he's my enemy, or so I'm told, and how do I reconcile his enemy-ness and our common humanhood? And I felt a strong sense of that in your reporting.
Well, it's one of the when Sadat talked about the psychological barriers that had to be broken down by his visit and by this process of talking together and negotiating for peace, I think that's really what he's talking about. The two sides basically have to get to know that the other side is people very much like them with very similar problems.
Do you get a sense at all that the hatreds that are felt between the Israelis and the Arabs have been orchestrated at all by the governments for other, you know, more economic-oriented reasons?
Well, I think that there's a lot of that. The Egyptians during Nasser's years were fed a steady stream of propaganda of the most vicious kind. The Syrians also, even in more recent years, have grown up thinking that Israelis, Jews are murderers and embarked on a scheme to take over the earth. And the most vicious propaganda now against the Israelis is, I guess, Iraqi and some of the Palestinian propaganda. On the other hand, I think that you find some institutional creation of an anti-Arabism within Israel. It's much more subtle. You don't, you know, you don't see pictures of Arabs with horns on their head or diabolical forms or drawn in the shape of animals, but you do find a sort of institutional prejudice that is reinforced by the government in public statements, in the education process, in their policy toward the territories that they've occupied, and in the reporting of incidents that where conflict has taken place between Arabs in the occupied territories and Jews, be they settlers or visitors from Israel proper.
I remember when the Vietnam War was going on, a lot of people in America felt that, well, gosh, if they went to another country, people would see them as an extension of American foreign policy, and that, you know, many foreigners couldn't separate the way American people were feeling from the way American policy was oriented. And for people who were against the war at the time when the war was being heavily fought, it was a very, a difficult thing to experience, knowing that this hostility was going to be placed on you, although you disagreed as violently as they did, perhaps, with the policy. Did you sense that at all in Israel or the Arab countries for many of the people there, people who felt really dissociated from the basic image of the country or the way the war was being fought?
Well, I think you find that particularly in Israel. Israel is a country that's much more free as to expressions of political dissent than any of the Arab countries that I visited, and they were many. In Israel, there is a full range of political opinion, and it is loud and it is very vocal. And you find people who will have nothing to do with the government's policy as to occupied territories or war or internal security with regard to the Arab population of Israel. And when you see these people visit the West Bank, for instance, or talk with Arabs who live in Israel, they have a sort of defensiveness about them, which they are trying to disassociate themselves from the policy of their government. I think that it's a little bit less of a problem for them, because the people whom they're trying to convince are a little closer to the situation than, say, a European was to the situation in America during the Vietnam War. It's well known among the Arabs that there is dissent within Israel, and there is a segment of the population that's given to more accommodation to the Palestinians and to the Arab cause. But I think that there's a lot of the cliche about Israel is that it's a nation of 3.5 million prime ministers. I mean, there are very few people who will go along with the government on everything. Everybody has a separate opinion, and there are so many minority reports on every question that you walk into a sea of talk every day. So there are a number of people who are trying to disassociate themselves from one policy or another.
I know, a lot of times when I'm just kind of watching TV or reading the newspapers about New York, it always sounds like, oh, God, I'm so glad I'm not in New York. Things are such a mess there. You know, there's either like a garbage strike or a transportation strike or newspaper strike or something. And you get there, and it's really not so bad. You know, you visit New York, and it's kind of typical, and maybe there's a garbage strike, so there's some garbage on the streets. People are basically ignoring it and carrying on as usual. When I read sometimes reports of the Middle East, I say, oh, my God, people are endangered every moment, no matter where they are. They risk being caught in terrorist attack or in the middle of some surprise skirmish, and you're just not safe. There's probably never a moment's peace, and people must be dying with anxiety. Is it like that?
No, not in the least. For the most part, it's the safest place that I have ever been. Growing up in America, I have been in more constant danger than I was anywhere in the Middle East. And if you happen to get caught in a zone where shells are coming in, naturally you're going to want to take cover. But for the most part, for instance, Cairo is a city of 9 million people. There's almost no crime at all. Any crime is thievery. It's not. It is in no way violent. In Israel itself, there's very little random violence between people. The danger zones are in places that are border areas or in the old city of Jerusalem. And even then, the incidents that get so much play over here of a bomb going off in a market or a bus being blown up are really not... They don't set the tone of the life there at all. People don't walk out of their house every morning wondering if they're going to get back at night. It's an area that's in constant ferment, but that doesn't mean that the people are in constant danger.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Ben Kramer, and he's spent a few years in the Middle East. His reporting from the Middle East has recently won him a Pulitzer Prize. The articles were done for The Inquirer. You say that you risk your life a lot more growing up in America than you did in the Middle East, but, I mean, let's face it, you traveled across, you know, the front lines, and the Arabs told you don't do it, the Israelis will kill you, and the Israelis told you don't do it, the Arabs will kill you. And of course, you survived it, but you might not have known you were going to survive it when you were doing it. Certainly both sides thought you were facing a lot of risk. What made you really do that? I mean, what made you really go through such risk? I mean, let's face it, it was.
Well, this is I think it's the same thing that that pushes any reporter to go and do one thing more than he might ordinarily do. You want to know. And you couldn't report that story without getting to the other side, which was the advancing Israeli army. But I must say that this is, you know, the Arabs were telling me don't go, and the Israelis were saying, how could you have gone, and such. But I had the advantage of knowing both sides and knowing that they didn't just kill at random and they weren't monsters. So it did not seem as dangerous to me as it seemed to them.
Were you wearing something large and visible that indicated, okay, I'm a reporter?
I was wearing my little suit. You know, I always wear a suit. And I had my little notebook out and came around this bend in the road, and here are these two enormous Israeli tanks and these 19-year-old soldiers on top of them who are scared to death. There's a gunman in every tree, and here comes this bozo up in his suit with his little pad and says, how are things going, you know? They were pretty astounded. There was nothing in their book of instructions to handle this. They didn't know quite what to make of this.
Were you with an interpreter then?
No, people had sort of dropped off along the way. I started with a fairly large party, and by the time the last cab driver absolutely refused to go onward, that was it after that. So at that point, I was alone. Usually, I was with interpreters, and I wish I had been with an interpreter at that time. Because you can do a lot more. You can go a lot deeper when you have somebody with you who speaks the language perfectly.
What was your sense of risk then?
At that time?
Yeah, I mean, did you think...
It's difficult to describe this feeling, but my sense of risk was more not being able to get back to Beirut in time to file that story that day than it was not getting back at all. I had business to do. I didn't have time to worry about anything else.
Oh, that sounds simple, but most people's business doesn't involve doing that. Would you fight in a war? I mean, you've been really close to war. But you've been there as an observer, as a reporter of it, as an interpreter of what's going on. You haven't been there fighting it, and being on the front lines with a machine gun in your hand is a different experience. And are you a pacifist? Would you fight a war? We're not involved in one now.
No, but if this country went to war, I believe I'd go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think... I had very deep problems about the war in Vietnam, but if this country went to war if this country were threatened and went to war, I believe I would certainly go.
You described these 19-year-old soldiers and the tanks who were very scared when you came across them. Did you experience that in the Arab countries and
both
in Israel?
Sides,
that...
Yes, they're... Well, it's a region of tremendous fear, largely because of what we were talking about, that the other side is unknown and its motives are largely unknown and its characteristics are unknown. And it's a region where the young men find themselves in situations which are totally out of their control. And this is a scary business. I felt many times on both sides, I felt very sorry for the people who were trapped in it.
You quoted an Israeli soldier, I think. And it wouldn't surprise me if this was maybe one of the quotes that got you a lot of mail. The quote was something like... Well, sure, sometimes we have to kill civilians, but if it's a choice between risking the life of an Israeli soldier or killing a civilian, we'll kill the civilian. Can you put that in context for us and tell us if you passed judgment at all on that quote and, like, what your motives were for including that in your story?
Well, this was an interesting young man. He was a soldier during the invasion by the Israelis of Lebanon. He's also in his second life or first life, depending on how you look at it. He is a law student. And he struck me as a very, he's a fine young man, very humane man. We had just, he and I had just gone into a bunker that had been abandoned by some PFLP Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine guerrillas to get some rice for a woman who had no food. And we were roaring around this abandoned and shot up Lebanese town in his Israeli army jeep. And he was saying, he was describing how the invasion had gone, and had said that no civilians could possibly have been killed, and such, which he at that point, I mean, it was clear to all he could not have known, but this was his belief. And we came up to a series of homes that had been badly shot up, and this old man came out and told us and showed us where the Israeli bullets had come into his home and had killed, I believe it was his son. And to the young man, the law student and soldier with whom I was writing, this was intensely embarrassing. It was a refutation of what he had been saying, and it was evidence that the Israeli assault, as beautifully orchestrated and as controlled as it was, could not, with the kind of force it mustered, could not help but injure some people who just happened to be in the way. When you're moving thousands of soldiers in with tanks and rockets and aerial attacks, you can't be that precise about where every bullet or every piece of metal goes. And so the old man proved, to the satisfaction of everybody in that party, that the bullets had indeed come into his house and had killed his son. And at that point, this young man, who was very torn by this, because I believe he felt some sympathy for the old man, said, "Well, we can't be sure of every bullet. We have to clear an area. We have to make it safe to come in, you know." And the reason that I put in the quote was, one often doesn't think of the reason on every quote, but I think that, going back on it, I think that the reason I put it in was because this is, I mean, he was a decent man. He was a good man. I think he was a good soldier, and I believe he's a good man. And his pain in having to come to this conclusion, it was a realization for him as well as for me and for the readers in Philadelphia. His pain upon learning that indeed civilians did get in the way of this tremendous assault said something to me about how out of control it was. I mean, he was a good man who learned that the operation that he was in did in fact kill someone who was totally innocent, a Lebanese, and not involved in the conflict at all. And that moment of his learning that and his having to face that said something to me about the scope of a conflict that no one could control.
Now, there was another side of that which you pointed out, and I don't remember if it was the same or a different article. There were some Israeli soldiers in a nearby trench, was the body of an Arab, and an Arab dressed in civilian clothes. You speculated perhaps a farmer. And the attitude of the Israelis towards this body was that it was a really hostile being, that it might as well have been a soldier, or a soldier with a machine gun, for that matter, that this incredible hostility was felt, although it was a civilian and probably an armed one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the purposes of going, that was a story in which we went into Lebanon behind the Israeli army and talked to the Lebanese who had been caught in this invasion and the Israelis who had performed the invasion. And one of the purposes was to show that, you know, the different attitudes with which the people came in and with which the people received this assault. And this was, the comments about this body in the trench were made by a young soldier, a very small man, a very thin and small Israeli soldier who was sort of painstakingly described in the piece. And he was sitting with his friends, and you could hear his stories growing, and you could hear how they would sound when he returned to Israel, and, you know, how the stories were getting more and more heroic, and you know, and how we blew this one up with an 05, and I turned and fired, and this one fell, you know, And the stories were, I mean, it was really getting to be real Green Beret, John Wayne stuff, you know. And then the only thing he had to show was this body of this man who had been blasted out of his little pickup truck. And the body, the man who had been killed was, well, he was an older man. He was in little carpet slippers, you know, little slippers. Not commando boots, no weapons around. Farm truck still had dirt in it. It didn't look to me like a tough commando assault. And it was, I think that the idea there, although again I have to tell you that when I'm reporting these things, I don't think of what is the idea of putting this in. But I think I'm going back on this, that the idea there is that the stories about these things and the perceptions of what we, you know, what we the soldiers did in this battle can be so different from the fact and can be so out of proportion by the time they get home that the reality of it, which is often very dismal indeed, is lost.
When you were in the Middle East, there were, and still are, I'm sure, a lot of reporters from many different countries who were there. Did you hang around a lot with press from this country and from other countries? Did you travel with them, drink with them, share stories?
Well, you run into them a lot. There are many, tremendous number, a lot of TV people, because when TV decides that something is a story, they go in, they are unbelievable, you know. They have planes waiting and fleets of taxi cabs and a lot of bozos who stand around and don't know what their jobs are. So there's a bunch of them hanging around, and they mostly don't have much to do because the TV is overstaffed by about 400%. But I found that our paths weren't the same paths, you know, because they were doing another kind of reporting. They were on very official stories, and so I would see them every once in a while, but I found I didn't have too much to talk to them about, and they thought I was some kind of wifty, you know, they thought I was a little bit out of it, you know. I didn't have the same stories to tell. And so we never really, I didn't get real chummy with the group that sat around at, I mean, there's a bar in every city where you know you're going to find them, and I didn't get real chummy with them. But they are around, and they have a sort of self-sufficient community that relies on them and the middle-level people at the embassies, the American embassies in those cities. And they have a little social round that makes up for really what they seem to miss here. And it's something that I didn't really get to spend too much time in because I was always sort of somewhere else.
What did you do when you weren't really seeking out a story? Or, you know, I mean, I imagine there had to be times when you became a civilian again as opposed to a reporter, you know, when you just, lounge around, do nothing, or read, or go drinking, or find friends or something. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you were in foreign countries where it's
yeah.
Always it's hard to get around in a country that isn't your own, I think.
Yeah.
For some people, it may be different.
This can be very lonely business, because not only are you not where your friends are, but, I mean, you don't even understand anything anybody's saying to you, which is very tough indeed. I found the best antidote Victorian novels, very thick Victorian novels. And Anthony Trollope and Charles Dickens were my saviors in some very bleak nights in Beirut and Iraq and such. At one point, I had a little item on expense accounts, which I had to file, which are the bane of existence, expense accounts. And it said sanity reading, you know, 395. And this was two Trollope novels, which are about a foot and a half thick, you know, and very, very good for diving into and losing the whole 20th century.
Did you have interpreters with you much of the time? I'm sure you needed them in order
almost all the time, yeah. If you don't, see, if you're going to do the kind of reporting that the Inquirer does, which is to get to individuals and to get the kind of detail about their lives and about what they think, which you don't often find in other newspapers. You need an interpreter who is very talented indeed. He has to be almost perfectly bilingual, and he has to be in a position and of a disposition to tell the unvarnished and absolute truth all the time. I mean, not only what the person said, but how he said it and exactly the right words, you know. And this is often a problem, because if you get an interpreter from a government or something, they have a point of view and they're interested in enforcing that point of view rather than giving you exactly what is going on. And the third thing is that the interpreter has to also be very charming, because if your interpreter is a pain in the neck, very few people are going to want to talk to you, no matter how sweet a guy you may be. You know, your interpreter is giving them the impression that you're some kind of jerk.
You were separate from a lot of the other reporters in the Middle East as far as you and the reporters were concerned, but I'm sure when you showed up at the door of a lot of people's homes, you were the press, period. I mean, you weren't like the press that's different from many other people in the press. You weren't on your way to winning a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, they'd have no reason to know that. So in what way were you treated when you'd show up at people's houses when someone had just died in the family and everyone's in mourning, and here you are and you're going to write what is going to end up being a very compassionate, compelling article, but they don't know that.
Well, they had no idea who I was, or, you know, you don't know how many times I spelled Philadelphia. Philadelphia is very tough indeed. There were several problems in that regard. Not only was I just the foreigner to start out with wherever I was, but the Inquirer is not known overseas very much. You know, people tend to know the New York Times. That's about it. And they know Newsweek and Time because they do circulate in international editions. And so first I had to, there was the problem of establishing that I came from a reputable newspaper that was indeed one of the largest and best regarded newspapers. And then there was the problem of getting across what I wanted, because people who had any experience with the American press tended to make statements rather than talk to you. If they were public officials, or if they were people who had ever talked to reporters on some story before, they would be trying to get their point of view across in a pat statement rather than discussing a matter or talking about it or saying how they felt or showing you what it was. So that was the second problem, was getting them to come to the point where they could just talk about something instead of issuing a statement which would be duly taken down on the little pad and then sent out over the wires.
I've always figured that for some people, if a reporter or a camera shows up in the door, and if you have a chance to be on the evening news or something, that even if you're suffering, you're going to, in a way, be a hero by the time the reporter's done, because you're going to be in print or on the television, and that somehow makes you almost like the character in a movie, you know, mm-hmm. that your suffering is somehow special or noticed, or your joy is special or noticed, and it becomes just a little more heroic and a little less ordinary. But when you're reporting for a foreign newspaper, no one,
that's
I
right.
imagine,
they
has
don't,
that sense.
They don't
see
your
see
newspaper,
it.
They don't know your newspaper, and they know their friends aren't going to see it either, so you lose a little bit of that advantage.
Did people want you to send them? Well, they probably wouldn't have
been able to
read it
anyways. Many,
many people
wanted the article sent, and some of them I was able to save their little paper with their names on it and actually send it. Many I was not able to. One of my problems was I didn't see the paper for a year. I was in no particular place. There was nowhere for them to send it. So I didn't even know what the stories were looking like and what was being done with them.
What kind of relationship did you have to your editors at the Inquirer when you were there?
Well, they were wonderful. They were everything from you know, nurses and moral support and fans and taskmasters. They kept me at it when I got lazy, and they gave me encouragement when I got depressed, and they held my hand and took mail and generally kept my life from sliding into total chaos here, although it got pretty close anyways. If you leave, one of the things I neglected to tell you was that when I left for Egypt around Christmas 77, it was supposed to be for 2 weeks. So I had one ratty little suit and I just left. You know, I didn't turn off the electricity or water the plants or anything. I just left. And it went on for a year, in the middle of which I announced I was coming back for clothes, and I came back, got some clothes, and went off again. But in the meantime, I had just left this life there, and lives don't tend to just go on functioning well in your absence. They tend to disintegrate totally. So I came back to just total chaos. I've spent a couple of months just getting my life back on the ground again.
Well, you're going to be taking off again soon.
That's right.
You're going to be based in London and doing international reporting from various countries there. I guess it's something you really want to continue doing now that you've started doing it.
Well, I'm excited about it. I think this would be a good job. This is based in London, but most of the work will be somewhere else, Africa or the Middle East. And the reason we picked London was because London is a very quick place to get out of, and the flow of information there is terrific. The British papers are good. The British radio and TV is good. And you tend to find out what's happening fast, and you can get there fast. And so the plan will be to have a sort of base of operations there and be on the road for 10 months a year.
At the age of, what, 28? You're 28?
28.
You've won a Pulitzer Prize. What is this? What does it mean to you? Does it, does it have, like, profound effect on your sense of self or your sense of your future or security?
Well, I don't think that it has a profound effect on your self concept, but, or at least not mine. I certainly hope not, anyways. What it's meant in the last couple of months is that I haven't really done much useful labor. I come into the office, there's a lot of mail, a lot of phone calls, and it's very weird business indeed, very heady business, you know. People, all of a sudden, people want you to come out to dinner. Some of them I've never met before, and it's all very flattering and very nice, but I must say I'd love to get back to reporting. So the plan is to get me out of the country where no one knows where this is, and then I'll get back to some useful labor.
Richard Kramer, I really wish you the best in your future travels and reporting and so forth. I want to thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks very much.
My guest has been Richard Ben Kramer. He's a reporter with The Enquirer. In this past year, he's won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from the Middle East. He's going to, as he explained to us, be leaving the country again shortly to be based in London to do more foreign reporting. Thanks again for being here.